Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Ross, Judge Rodenberg, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you. Our first case this morning is the State of Minnesota versus Joseph Van Gilder. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument, respondent 15 minutes, and then the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So if you can just begin, counsel for the appellant, by telling us who you are, and then the clock will start. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the court. Tim Drosky, representing the defendant, Mr. Joseph Van Gilder. Mr. Van Gilder's convictions must be overturned because the seizure of the van he was driving and the seizure of himself personally violated fundamental principles regarding the prohibition against unconstitutional seizures. First, with respect to the seizure of the van, it is well established that without probable cause, law enforcement cannot impound a vehicle for the sole purpose of conducting an investigation. Here, this is that unique case where the factual record is clear that conducting such an investigation, here the canine sniff, was the precise and sole purpose that Officer Weber had the vehicle impounded. For that reason alone, Mr. Van Gilder's drug convictions must be overturned. Second, with respect to the seizure of Mr. Van Gilder himself, an officer may only temporarily seize a person if the officer has a specific, articulable, and reasonable basis to suspect that specific person of criminal activity. Mere proximity to or association with the person who may have previously engaged in criminal activity is not enough to support reasonable suspicion. Here, the officer's suspicions that the female Mr. Van Gilder was with may have been the subject of an outstanding warrant. Mr. Van Gilder's representation that he was there to see Ms. Kelly Brendan, the subject of the outstanding warrant, and the officer's suspicions with respect to Mr. Van Gilder's female companion's answers on her lack of ID did not give Officer Weber reasonable suspicion to seize Mr. Van Gilder himself. For that reason, all of his convictions must be overturned. So I'd first like to focus on the seizure of the van. You know, it was the second issue briefed, but it provides such a bright line rule that I'd like to focus on it here. As already stated, the well-settled law on this is that the impoundment and search of a vehicle is improper when it is done for the sole purpose of investigation. And that is stated in the Minnesota Supreme Court decision of State v. Tour, based on State v. Holmes, and was reiterated by this court just 2 months ago in the recent unpublished decisions of Roybal and Lopez, which we provided as supplemental authority. So the standard in this court is that if the investigatory motive was the sole purpose behind the search, it's impermissible, and the sole purpose behind the impoundment. And the test then is whether the impoundment would not have occurred but for the investigatory motive. Here, the factual record is clear that the sole reason that Officer Weber impounded the vehicle was because of that investigatory motive, that he wanted the canine sniff performed.
Mr. Drosky, could you tell me, if they had just kept the van there and waited for the dog, would that have been improper?
That would have been proper, Your Honor. The difference there is the vehicle wouldn't have been seized in the same way. It's the impoundment itself that is the focal point. That's the seizure that occurs. And the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Rode makes that clear, that you focus on the impoundment in the first instance because it's the impoundment that is the seizure and raises the constitutional concerns. So no, we don't dispute that if it had been done at the scene, that would have been proper here.
But just so we're clear, you're suggesting then that an officer could walk down the street with his canine and do a dog sniff around any lawfully parked vehicle without it being a constitutionally significant event?
Well, we don't contest here that the officer had reasonable suspicion. He had looked into the vehicle and saw that it was looked lived in. He claims that there was enough to give him reasonable suspicion of potential drug use, but also made clear on the record that there was not probable cause, and that was on page 85 of the transcript. And so this case doesn't raise the situation of just an officer walking down the street with a canine trying to do a dog sniff. The difference is that
been stopped in traffic under these circumstances, would the officer have had constitutional grounds to detain your client, assume that there was no arrest, But could the officer have detained your client long enough to get a dog sniff while the car was sitting there without violating your client's constitutional rights?
We don't dispute that Mr. Van Gilder, if he had not been arrested, could still have been detained for a reasonable period of time. And the question of what reasonable is could vary on the facts, would depend on the facts of the case. But we're not disputing here that the dog sniff could have occurred at the scene where it occurred. The key difference here is that it was impounded.
Constitutional intrusion, do you suppose? The detention of an individual, prohibiting any movement, restriction on his liberty, so that the officers can get a dog sniff over to the scene and sniff, or removing the driver's car that's not being used by the driver to another location to conduct the dog sniff. Which is the greater constitutional intrusion?
Well, here, Your Honor, Mr. Van Gilder was already under arrest.
Right.
And so his personal detention, we contest that his seizure of himself personally was improper, but setting that aside for right now.
My hypothetical is, I'm sorry, I'm trying to present a hypothetical. Let's assume that there was a stop in traffic and that there was no basis to make an arrest, but that the officer had reasonable suspicion to conduct a dog sniff. Which is a greater constitutional intrusion? My hypothetical, where the officers are detaining the driver until the dog can show up to conduct a sniff, or the facts of this case, where the driver is gone from the scene, is not going to be using the car, may not even be aware of what's happening to the car because he's being detained under arrest, and the car is removed to another location to conduct the dog sniff. Which is a greater constitutionally significant event? Which is a greater intrusion to the driver?
Well, there's a fundamental difference in a temporary detention at the scene based on reasonable suspicion, under Terry and its progeny, and moving a vehicle from the public place where it lies to a police station to conduct the canine sniff.
I understand there's apples and oranges here. We're talking about, on the one hand, about detaining an individual temporarily, and the other, seizing a vehicle. Assume it's temporary. Let's assume that the dog sniff occurred and there was no drugs, and they could move the car back, tow it back to the place where it was left. As a practical matter, I'm trying to get a sense of which of those do you think is a greater intrusion in the driver's rights? Which has a greater impact on the driver?
Well, I think the law is settled that a driver can be temporarily, if a driver is temporarily detained based on reasonable suspicion, that's permissible. What the law clearly says, and thus is the greater violation here, is that you can't impound a vehicle without probable cause based solely on an investigatory motive.
Oh, I understand. I understand the legal argument. I'm just trying to pick at the principle underlying it. I'm trying to get a sense of whether it makes sense. So I wanted you to theorize with me a bit which one of those circumstances has a greater impact on the individual.
Well, I think I think the vehicle being impounded has a fundamental and great impact on the individual.
If he might not have known that it was removed and the dog sniff conducted on the outside of it, assuming my hypothetical that the dog sniff was conducted offside after it was towed, no drugs were detected, and then the vehicle is towed back and placed exactly where it was left, legally parked. Same answer?
Yes, same answer. For law enforcement to seize someone's property, move it to their police station, hold on to it, and return it, that's a constitutional violation of significance when they don't have probable cause to do it. and whether the person is aware of it, whether they're able to get access to the van, to the vehicle themselves, the seizure, the unconstitutional seizure is still the unconstitutional seizure. It's significant.
The state argues, Mr. Drosky, that Mr. Van Gilder had been arrested and that no other arrangements had been made for anyone else to take control of the van, and that that makes a difference. What's your response to that?
The fact that he had already been arrested here doesn't matter, because Officer Weber was clear and unequivocal that the sole reason that he did impound the vehicle was to do the canine sniff. So again, the test under State v. Tour is whether the impoundment would have occurred but for that investigatory motive. Here, Officer Weber was unequivocal. You know, if you look at pages 55 of the transcript, 85 through 87, that's the only reason he did it. He said, you know, if I wasn't going to do that canine sniff, I wouldn't have impounded the vehicle. So there are other cases, you know, usually this kind of legal issue comes up when you're arguing pretext, like that was the case in the Roybal situation, where there are reasonable reasons why an officer could impound the vehicle, like them being under arrest, for example. But then the defendant is arguing that that was just pretextual and that the real reason was to do an investigation. That's not what you have here. Yes, he was under arrest. Yes, if that had been the stated reason for why it was impounded, we'd have a very different case here. But when Officer Weber clearly testified that the only reason he did it was for the canine sniff, then the fact that he was under arrest, the fact that no one else took possession of it, doesn't matter here. That's the key issue.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. No. Had you finished your answer?
Yes.
Okay. I'd like you to turn your attention to the other issue that you raised, which is the seizure of your client personally. I have a clear sense of where you believe the constitutionally significant moment occurred after the officer approached.
Yes. So the constitutionally significant moment was when, you know, he approached, said he was there looking for someone with an outstanding warrant, and then asked for their IDs. And that puts this case squarely under Cripps.
What about the way the district court characterized it, which is that the officer asked whether your client would be willing to engage in a discussion, and your client freely involved himself in the discussion? Do you believe that was, I'm trying to get a sense of whether you think that bears on our analysis.
Right. We don't dispute that the officer asked if they would speak to him and that they said yes. But of course, the standard is whether a reasonable person would feel like they could leave in that situation. And what Cripps makes clear is that when the officer's questions to the individual are essentially asking them to prove their innocence, that a seizure then occurs, even if it's first seems to be a voluntary interaction. So in Cripps, it was, you know, going into a bar, asking for ID because to try to see if people were underage drinkers. Here you have the same thing, because Officer Weber's question, you know, when he introduced himself, he said, I'm here to see if there's a female with an outstanding warrant. Following up and immediately asking for someone's ID is essentially asking them to prove that they're not the individual with an outstanding warrant. It's the same situation as Cripps, and that's why it wasn't, even if they consented to talk, that's why they were seized at that moment in time.
It seems like Cripps is, I'm sorry, are you done? It seems like Cripps is a different factual situation and sort of an outlier in that it was at the Albatross Bar in Mankato, with which in my younger days I was quite familiar. And it's very near a college campus and was frequented by, I mean, the facts in that case are, as you know, sort of a prove yourself innocent sort of approach. And I'm not sure that I understand that this is the same sort of situation. The officer says, as Judge Ross asked, the officer says, are you willing to visit about whether, you know, who you are? And they visit with them. I don't understand that to be the same.
Well, he didn't ask to visit with them about who they are. He asked if he could speak with them. But where it makes it the same is when he says, I'm there to find somebody with an outstanding warrant. The way that the officer is going to know whether they have an outstanding warrant or not is based on who the people he's engaging with are, right? And so in the same way as Cripps, giving the ID
How would the officer approach in a way that wouldn't violate the Constitution? What could the officer have said, in your view, that would have been constitutionally permissible?
Well, he didn't violate the Constitution with respect to Mr. Van Gilder's female companion. He had reasonable suspicion there because he thought that she looked like the person that he was there to see.
With your client, what more could he have said than, hey, would you mind having a conversation with me? Obviously, he could say something and make it a non-constitutionally significant event. What would it have been?
Sure, the difference is asking for the ID. That's the difference. Is asking for Mr. Van Gilder's ID. He could have had that whole exchange, but once he asked for his ID, then he's essentially, that's when the seizure occurred. It's that question that created the seizure.
Is there a way he could have asked for the ID without it being constitutionally inappropriate?
No, not as to Mr. Van Gilder, because that was the moment.
No matter what, an officer, there's no way the officer could have phrased the inquiry, the request to see the ID, that would have avoided a constitutional moment, in your view.
Well, or he could have done it by approaching them and not saying that he was there to see Miss Brenda, that he was looking for someone with an outstanding warrant. But it's the combination of the two.
Okay, so you're saying if he didn't mention the outstanding warrant, but everything else occurred as it happened, you're conceding then that would not have been a constitutionally significant encounter.
Correct. Right. It's the identification that he's there looking for someone with an outstanding warrant that then makes the request for ID a constitutional seizure, and one for which he lacked reasonable suspicion as to Mr. Van Gilder, even if he had it for the female companion. And I see my time's up.
Judge Connolly, can I ask one short question on this subject?
I think go right ahead, Judge Rodenberg.
I understand that your argument is that because he couldn't have been the subject of the warrant, that renders the asking for identification unconstitutional. Am I right?
Correct.
Well, doesn't that itself take it outside of Cripps? That is that he's not being asked to prove himself not to be the subject of the warrant because the officer already knows that.
I would say, Your Honor, though, that a reasonable person, when approached by an officer and asked that question in that context, knowing that he's looking for people with outstanding warrants, would not feel free to leave in that situation and would be seized.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Droski. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
Please the court, counsel. I am Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petrus, and I am representing the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. I'd like to address two points, and I think I will address them in the same order the argument has proceeded thus far. First, talking about the officer's decision to tow the red van, and then returning to the moment in time in which I believe the individual, the appellant, was constitutionally seized. Turning first to that towing of the red van, there's a difference between inventory search case law, like Gouster and Rohde and Detman, and what happened in this case. In those inventory search cases, the validity of the impoundment in turn justified or did not justify the inventory search that followed it. But here, the impoundment was not the justification for the search of the vehicle. It was simply a means of preserving the police's opportunity to conduct an exterior dog sniff of that vehicle. And I encourage this court to view a vehicle like other personal property that is mobile, such as a cell phone. Those items can be physically moved without subjecting the items themselves to a search.
Okay, let's take you with that offer for that hypothetical. An officer encounters individuals in a traffic stop and asks, were you using your cell phone while you were driving? And the officer has reasonable suspicion to inquire further about the phone. I gather your view is that the officer could, without violating the driver's constitutional rights, seize the phone take it to the police department without needing anything further, that itself is not a constitutional deprivation.
I believe that is correct. After Arizona v. Gant, the search incident to arrest exception does not apply to vehicles. And after Riley v. California, it does not apply to cell phones. Under that hypothetical, Judge Ross, the police could not do anything more than take the cell phone. They could not look onto it to confirm the reasonable suspicion they have that it was used illegally. They would have to find another exception to the warrant requirement, or they would have to get a search warrant, like what happened in this case, to access the cell phone.
Okay, let's look at it a different way. Let's say it's not a cell phone, but the officer looks in the car and sees a woman with her purse and has reason to suspect that there are drugs in the purse, but not probable cause to actually search the purse. Your view is that the officer could seize the purse, take it to the police department, and hold it there until a drug sniffing dog was available to sniff the purse, and that the seizure itself is not a constitutionally significant moment. Is that your view?
Not entirely. I think under that hypothetical, the woman, if she's a passenger in the car, if I'm understanding that correctly, you'd need to get another way of getting inside that car to get to the woman's purse. Is that woman arrested?
She's standing outside the car. She's holding her purse. The officer thinks maybe there's drugs inside. Believe there might be drugs inside. And she's standing outside holding her purse. Your view is that the officer can take that purse from her, take it to the police department, and hold it until such time as a drug sniffing dog is available to determine whether the dog will alert onto it. That's your view.
I don't believe so. I think it's different than what I'm arguing here. And the key difference is you were talking about before in terms of that constitutionally significant intrusion, or in the hypothetical that you were discussing with Mr. Drosky, is the person isn't present anymore under the facts that we have here. In the hypothetical that you just described, the woman is physically holding the purse.
So your view is that under the Fourth Amendment, as long as the person is not there, law enforcement can seize the person's property.
If it is parked on a public street, if the woman's purse is sitting in a public area that anyone has a right to go to, whether that's the street or the sidewalk, yes, and the officer has reason to believe there is something incriminating inside that object, whether it's a purse or a car, they can seize it. It's a different analysis, obviously, if the personal property is on private real property.
Just to be clear, this was not a search incident to arrest.
Correct.
We're talking in our case. So in your view, an officer could walk down the street, suspect, let's say there was no arrest made, but walk by a car, believe it belongs to a drug dealer, have reason to suspect there are drugs inside, no arrest, no other involvement with law enforcement, but your view is the police can just hook the car up, tow it, and then at some later time, when a dog is available, conduct a dog sniff, and that the seizure itself is not a constitutional violation.
I believe that is true, but it wouldn't be acting on a whim. They would have to have the reasonable articulable suspicion.
Reasonable suspicion. I am assuming reasonable suspicion. You can just impound cars as you drive down the street, if you don't have a drug dog available, and take it down to the police department for a sniff.
My car has been impounded just off the street itself, not for drug-related reasons, but it's happened to me personally. And yes, I think it goes back to what you were discussing with Mr. Drosky, Judge Ross, that if that situation, if there is reasonable articulable suspicion to justify that dog sniff, it is not constitutionally significant whether that happens at the scene of where the vehicle is found or stopped, or whether that happens where a dog is actually going to be available in the police station. If the dog comes back negative, it's just returned to where it was.
I thought from constitutional text once a seizure occurs, that is a constitutionally significant moment, period.
I think it is constitutionally significant, but I think it is reasonable under the Fourth Amendment because of the reasonable articulable suspicion that was provided in this case, as appellant concedes, and that is, I think, embedded in the hypothetical.
But, you know, in every other circumstance, when it comes to actually seizing a person's property, you need probable cause to seize. Reasonable suspicion in any other circumstance doesn't give you the right as a police officer to actually take their property. Is there another circumstance you can think of where reasonable suspicion by itself is enough for a seizure as opposed to probable cause?
Reasonable articulable suspicion is all that's required to seize any person at any time. And that is the standard for what is a seizure under Terry.
To seize personal property.
It depends on where that personal property is. If it's on a public street or it's on a public sidewalk without being in someone's on someone's person, then reasonable articulable suspicion is all that is necessary.
And the case that you rely upon.
Or it's in their house. That's not enough.
So the case that you're relying upon for the proposition that reasonable suspicion is all you need to seize property when it's left in a public place, legally parked if it's a car, is what? What is the case that supports that proposition, that reasonable suspicion is enough?
I think Terry v. Ohio and subsequent case law interpreting it established that when a seizure occurs, that is all that is necessary.
Terry versus Ohio, forgive me, Terry versus Ohio was a temporary detention of an individual.
And that's what we're talking about here, is temporary detention of
an individual. I thought we were talking about seizure of personal property.
I'll point you to the five cases from out of state that I cited in the supplemental authority letter that I filed earlier this week. And to they collectively stand for the proposition that whether you're detaining a vehicle and whether that is whether that is keeping an officer stationed at the scene where the vehicle was found or stopped, or whether that's by towing it where a drug sniffing dog can be available later, those are different acts than the separate act of conducting an inventory search of the vehicle. A dog sniff is not a search, especially a dog sniff of a vehicle. And whether that dog sniff occurs on the side of the road or whether it occurs at the police station conceptually makes no real difference. And I think it is important.
I'm just struggling with this. It seems like I'm not understanding or you're not understanding that there are two different constitutionally significant events. There is a search or a quasi-search with the dog sniff, and there is a seizure. Those are two separate things requiring separate constitutional justification. You disagree with that?
I think that the reasonable articulable suspicion that wasn't to justify the dog sniff justifies the dog sniff as well as the temporary seizure of the vehicle to another location where the dog sniff can occur. Yes, and I would point you to State v. Roy, which is what the district court relied on, which I cite in my brief, and I understand that deals with probable cause. But I think the principle is about whether the facts that justify that legal standard, whether it's reasonable articulable suspicion or the higher standard of probable cause, whether those, as long as those facts exist, it can happen in one of two locations.
Why? I mean, you need probable cause to seize a person's property. In that case, there was probable cause. In this case, there's no probable cause.
Yes, I read one of the principles from Roy differently. I read it as I tried to explain in my brief. If there is a set of facts that existed, and they existed at the time at the scene, that they can justify that same act, that dog occurring in a short time later, later on somewhere else, as like you pointed out before, the property could be returned if the dog sniff comes back with negative results. I think it's the limited resources of many small police departments, and Robbinsdale is just one of them. And it's true throughout the state. The act of towing a van to a safe location temporarily so that it could be not searched, but have an exterior dog sniff conducted, that was ultimately reasonable under these unique facts. I think that's what the officer explained at the hearing.
I gather you're saying that there are things that the Robbinsdale police can do that would be constitutional that the Minneapolis police couldn't do.
If the resources became an issue with Minneapolis Police Department and their record established that?
I'm assuming they don't have the resource restriction that you're talking about. You're saying that it matters in the constitutional analysis if you had a large, fully staffed police department with full resources, they could do exactly the same thing that occurred here, but it might be unconstitutional for them, but constitutional for the Robbinsdale officer?
I wasn't trying to make that. I was trying to explain why it was reasonable under these unique facts. I guess I would need to know the specific resource situation of Minneapolis. It's probably less likely to be reasonable in that situation.
Well, the Fourth Amendment doesn't seem to have an efficiency clause.
I agree. In this particular situation, another way, and consistent with Mr. Drosky's view, that the police could have proceeded is by requiring the only other police squad that was on duty at that time to stay at the scene and take everyone off the streets until a dog sniff from a different jurisdiction or a drug detection dog from a different jurisdiction was able to respond. The officer chose not to do that, instead to temporarily.
Why is that a problem? Why is that a problem for an individual's constitutional rights, whether the police department is busy? We're so busy, we're going to have to seize you today and take you to jail without probable cause because it's just so efficient.
I'm not saying that the community caretaker exception warrant requirement justifies this, but consistent with that concept of the police being responsible for protecting the community, I think the view was that the would be a best practice in the event of an emergency to have an officer available to respond if something else happens.
Mr. Petras, I guess what you're telling us is you're relying Roy. That's the closest case you've got, you know, that says the police could do what they do, right?
I think the out-of-state cases that I described, I think Roy, are support for Officer Weber.
I think the panel does have some concerns with the seizure. And I mean, I'm just looking at the reply brief where the appellant points out that, you know, the big differences in Roy is that there was probable cause to believe that the vehicle had been used as an instrumentality of a crime and it contained evidence of a crime. And here, your own officer said there wasn't. I mean, that seems problematic to me. So why am I wrong? And I guess my time is up, but I'll let you answer my question. Thank you.
It seems as if Mr. Petras has...
Did I lose you? I'm sorry. Can you guys still hear me?
Now we can.
Previous cases like, oh great, sorry about that. Previous cases like Roy have discussed or applied probable cause as the standard, as just Judge Ross and I were just discussing. I think the principle behind Roy is that the movement from one place to another of mobile property, whether that's cell phone, whether that's vehicle, that is not as constitutionally significant as the act of searching itself. There was no search that was done of this car until there was indisputably probable cause based on that dog sniff. This is a dog sniff case. It's not an inventory search case. And granted, it's a dog sniff case with a twist, but I would encourage you to read Roy for everything it stands for, as opposed to just limited to that probable cause standard that it applies.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Drosky, you'll have the last word, so you may give your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Probable cause does make all the difference here. And This court's decision in Detman makes that clear. There, the court focused on the impoundment as the focal point of the inquiry and said that the impoundment was improper because it was done solely for an investigatory purpose and there was no probable cause. The absence of probable cause is dispositive, and the focus on the impoundment is the critical point of the constitutional inquiry. State v. Road by the Minnesota Supreme Court makes clear that it's the impoundment that is the focus, and this court applying that basic principle in Detman, again, fully supports that. I would also urge the court to look at each of the five decisions cited by the state, because none of them disprove the clear law under Minnesota precedent that the focus is on the impoundment and that the impoundment is an unconstitutional seizure when done for the sole purpose of an investigation. Unless this court has further questions, I have nothing further.
Thank you very much, Mr. Drosky. Thank you, Mr. Petras. We appreciate your hard work and diligence, and please stay safe. The matter is now submitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.